Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have been privileged week after week now for well over a year, I believe, to have the opportunity to talk to one of the most intelligent men I know. His name is J.R. Nyquist, known to his friends as Jeff. He has contributed mightily to the public policy discourse on a whole host of issues, most having some bearing on the national security of the United States through platforms including his blog, which is terrific, jrnyquist.blog, and at outlets like Newsmax and Epic Times. He is a regular here, I'm very pleased to say, and we have talked with him, among other things, about his periodical writings as well as his books, including The Fool and His Enemy. And it's always a privilege to be able to do so. And Jeff, thank you for taking some time with us today. It's good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with something I know you have been doing some deep study on, Jeff, and that is the grand strategy that animates, unfortunately, serious enemies of the United States, like Russia and most especially Communist China. Give us a bit of a flavor of how they have come to understand and practice grand strategy as something essential to their foreign and national ambitions, especially as they relate to the destruction of enemies like us.
Yeah, well, grand strategy, it turns out, flows directly from philosophy. And this is illustrated across the board in the past of the Soviet Union, before World War II, and during the Cold War, and today. For example, because their philosophy is a revolutionary ideology or a revolutionary outlook, as Stalin would call it, their military was predicated on offensive weapons before World War II, which is one of the reasons why when Hitler attacked them, they suffered so badly, because they had not developed their defensive weapons. They didn't have good fighter interceptors. They had fighter escorts. Their tanks were made for attacking rather than defending. The BT-7, for example, was made to go on the Autobahn to put inflatable tires on it, not to be used on Russia's mud road.
Tundra, yeah.
Right. And so there was consequences to this that turned out to be negative. But during the Cold War, for example, you have Sokolovsky's military strategy, and it was to fight and win a nuclear war, which is completely alien to our Western conceptions, but it had to do with their revolutionary thinking. If you're going to have a revolution, that means an offensive. You fight on the enemy's territory. You come to the aid of a rebellion, of a communist rebellion, and that's offensive warfare. And of course, the same applies to China and China's outlook today. Their Marxism-Leninism also causes them to create their policies, and that is their larger grand strategy, based around their philosophy. So the connection between the kind of strategies and, of course, grand strategy that a country adopts is intimately bound up with its ideology, its political thinking. And in the case of the communists, this thinking, the immorality of the thinking, both gives them advantages because the communists really don't, because they're materialists, they don't believe in God, they don't believe in the kind of morality people who believe in religion have. And so they have no moral restrictions in the kind of creative strategic thinking that they can use.
So pure evil can be translated into grand strategy without being encumbered by ethics or morality, as you say, or any other kinds of constraints that, if you are God-fearing people, you would have to operate under. And that's a challenge to us. And we're going to talk more about us and grand strategy, but stay, if you would, with this idea, Jeff, of nuclear war fighting. This is, as you say, something that is foreign to American, you know, policymakers. Find mostly they say that nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. That is not the view of, well, the old Soviet regime or of Vladimir Putin's, as best I could tell, nor, I think, that of the Chinese Communist Party, is it?
Well, they may give lip service to drive the point home to our public that they believe that a nuclear war is the end of the world, but that's propaganda or disinformation. What they really think is in their strategic literature, and that shows that they have absolutely no real problem with waging a full-on nuclear war. In fact, I remember speaking to Colonel Stanislav Lunov about it years ago, saying that Americans...
He was one of the top defectors from the old GRU, the military intelligence branch of the Soviet Union, right?
He was involved in Soviet and also Russian Federation military plans before his defection. And when I told him, you know, American policymakers don't really believe nuclear weapons are meant to be used. They're just to look pretty and to scare the other side. And he looked at me with a kind of shock, like they really think that. And he says, well, why would they think you couldn't have a nuclear war? Because the thing is that when you, like, if you open Sokolovsky, if you open the book, which Sokolovsky was the great Soviet military strategist of the Second World War and of the Cold War, he edited the book. And if you open the first pages, it says, well, every war, more and more people die, you know, and they went through the percentage of civilians and military personnel that died in, you know, past wars in the 18th and 19th century. They get to the 20th century and it starts accelerating and saying, well, nuclear war is just part of this progression, that war just by nature claims more lives. And this is like a natural,
more efficient means of killing large numbers of people.
Right. It's more attrition because science is advancing the methods of killing and so on. And this is just something you have to accept because after all, we're...
And adapt to and exploit, right?
And exploit, because we're scientists and we just accept the scientific fact.
Jeff, let me ask you about one other piece of this, which I think is particularly telling, and it gets very little attention in our country. There's a doctrine, and I think actually we pay lip service to it, that you need to train as you intend to fight. Vladimir Putin personally participates frequently in strategic forces exercises in which the Russian rocket forces simulate thermonuclear attacks against the United States. I mean, he makes no secret about this. He's seen in the conning towers of submarines and in command centers and the like. And we have to take a short break, Jeff, but when we come back, I want to ask you about the distinct possibility that that means that those exercises are what the Russians intend to do to us as part of their grand strategy. We'll continue this conversation with the great J.R. Nyquist on the other side of a short break and get into what we must be doing as opposed to what we are to be prepared for these sorts of strategic attacks from our enemies. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Jeff Nyquist. You can follow his writings at jrnyquist.blog. Jeff, we've been talking a bit about our two greatest adversaries, the Russians under Vladimir Putin, drawing on their experiences of the Soviet Union and Communist China under Xi Jinping, engage in serious strategic thinking and planning and even exercising for attacks against our country and other efforts to take us down. I wanted to just complete the thought about what it says to us that you have a leader like Vladimir Putin personally commanding Some of these exercises, are they, as we claim we do, training as they intend to fight? And what does that tell us about the prospects of nuclear attack from Russia, if not from China as well, on this country?
Well, it's a very serious, they take this very seriously, much more seriously than we do. I mean, the American public doesn't have civil defense. 4 years ago, Russia ran a civil defense drill, a nuclear war civil defense drill for the whole country. And that's something we've never done in this country.
Which would involve them heading into bomb shelters and taking advantage of other civil defense preparations, as well as testing missile defenses and the like, right?
And Russia's cities have massive civil defense under the metro in Moscow, for example. The tunnels connect to office structures and blast shelters underneath office structures. The Russians maintain regiments of construction troops for clearing the rubble after a nuclear exchange to rescue people trapped in their blast shelters. So this is how seriously they take it. We have no such infrastructure at all in this country. And in fact, the Russians are so good at this, they've prepared so well that when there's an earthquake in Pakistan or Iran or somewhere, you read about, oh, the Russians are sending this equipment. Well, that's the equipment. They're sending this equipment, nuclear war clearing equipment, to rescue people trapped in blast shelters.
And those blast shelters include deeply buried leadership facilities, as I understand it. And there was, at least in the old Soviet days, a dedicated subway line from the Kremlin over to those underground facilities. Is that still the case, as far as you know?
Most of the major cities in the former Soviet Union have enormous blast shelters hundreds of feet underground under the cities, for every ministry of the government has one.
Think about it, folks. This is a tell, as they say in Las Vegas, of the seriousness, as you say, Jeff, but also of the commitment to fighting and surviving, indeed winning, nuclear war. So this is evidence, again, of a great deal of strategic thought and preparation on their part. And I understand that a similar level of effort is made by the Chinese in terms of their strategic investments. I'm fond of saying on this program, Jeff, as I may have with you, that among other tells with respect to the Chinese is that they have invested 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels for the purpose of protecting, well, presumably their strategic rocket forces, but who knows what all else. And I imagine that there's leadership protection and other like, defensive activities involved as well. No?
Yeah, the Great Wall Project is sort of on the same scale, or an attempt to be on the same scale, that the Russians have built. The Russians have also built underground cities in the Urals. A lot of their production infrastructure, especially their military production infrastructure, is already located underground and is war, nuclear war survivable. The expense, by the way, that they went to is unfathomable for us. We couldn't imagine. It was estimated in the mid-1970s by General Keegan of Air Force Intelligence that it was in what we would reckon in not just the hundreds of billions, but perhaps the trillions.
And that's back when $1 trillion was a lot of money.
Yes, of course, they started in, if they're calculating, of course, they started in doing this in the early 1960s, and they were dedicated decade after decade, and they've never stopped. And so when you ask whether they're serious about a war, their military very much is. And even more so now, after the Russian Federation, after the first decade of the Russian Federation, there was a power shift within the Russian Federation to the generals. The generals became more powerful. The secret police, you've got Putin as a representative of the secret police, but what I've been told is that the secret police, because they were very much connected to the Communist Party, which is still there and underground, their strategy was considered to have failed. Their strategy of faking the collapse of the Soviet Union did not bring the immediate benefits that they expected. And so what happened when they, as they changed their system, the military generals were saying, you're going to have a war. You're going to have to look at this more seriously. And so it was the generals that were always saying, because they were believers in the philosophy of Clausewitz, not Sun Tzu, not deception, that deception can't do everything, that in the end you will have to fight a war, and that has created this greater emphasis, and why this Putin is doing these exercises in person.
Well, Jeff, it would be bad enough if we had not, in the face of all of this, allowed our strategic deterrent forces to atrophy terribly. I mean, again, you talk about the American people not understanding the full import of all of this, many of them, but they certainly are unaware of the parlous state of our strategic missiles and submarines and so on, the weapons platforms themselves, but most especially the nuclear warheads. But it's worse than that, in a sense. We've not really been doing much strategic thinking, certainly by comparison to these adversaries, have we?
No. In fact, our strategic thinking is sort of based around our consumer society mentality, which is convenience. It's like, well, this is all kind of inconvenient. Let's just say it all works and just carry on.
Whistle past the graveyard, as they say.
Yes, very much. This is very dangerous. This is not something that a serious power in the nuclear age can afford to do.
Amen. So, Jeff, I would argue that it would be bad enough that we're not terribly serious about strategic thought and preparations and practice. But I'm not sure that we're even doing a very good job on sort of understanding the tactics of our enemies, let alone their strategies. And I'm given to thinking this in connection in part with what we've been seeing happening in the United States in the past year or so, in terms of, well, the Chinese call it United Front Department activities. The idea that we can be not only threatened from outside this country, but that we can have fifth columns or subversive elements using techniques like direct action against us, whether that's civil unrest and rioting, or whether it's perhaps provocative actions. I tend to think that's what went on the 6th of January, for example, on Capitol Hill. Talk a little bit about that, and whether I'm missing something, or are we missing the ball on the need to understand both strategy and tactics of our foes?
Well, we don't understand their tactics because we don't study our enemy. But the thing that we fail really in studying our enemy, and I've read countless books that I'm thinking, I got to put this book away because it doesn't get it, is because we don't connect their tactics to their grand strategy or their strategy, and we don't connect the strategy to their philosophy, because they all flow together. And the denial of who they are and what their morality is and their objectives are, that denial leads to a denial of what their grand strategy is and what their tactics are.
So when you net all that out, and I'd ask you to specifically address this question of, are we leaving ourselves open, not just, again, to the worst of possible scenarios of a thermonuclear attack on our country, but are we perhaps even inviting other sorts of aggression against us by our failure to appreciate that adversaries who are using front groups in this country that they've established in some cases over many years to subvert us from within represent a very serious threat as well, against which we are similarly unprepared?
Well, the biggest failure is to realize the communist, aspect, the philosophical communist aspect of the threat, which is so fundamental. I mean, to believe that, for example, the Russian Federation, people say, oh, it's not a communist country. Ostensibly, openly, outwardly, it's not. But you look at its policies, they're supporting every communist regime in Africa, every communist regime in Latin America. They're supporting China. They have military advisors and are giving sustenance to the North Koreans. Why is this consistent support for communism across the board on the part of the Russian Federation? And then you hear Vladimir Putin bragging that he never got rid of his party card. And he gives speeches to communist groups. He says, I'm with you. You're our guys. But we just, you know, denial is not a river in Egypt goes the joke, but it really true that we're in denial about who these people really are. And one of the
We are hard out of time and a lot more to talk about. I know that we'll be revisiting this with you next week, but I just wanted to say that, you know, to some extent, it seems to me what is going on here is denial indeed, and a willful blindness that unfortunately has to be corrected if we are to protect our country against, as many of us swore an oath to do, all enemies, foreign and domestic. Jeff Nyquist, thank you for your time today, as well as the great expertise you bring to bear on all of these subjects. Check out his book, The Fool and His Enemy, and his website, jrnyquist.blog. We'll talk with you again next week, Jeff. Thank you. Next up, we will speak with the great Gordon Chang about China and the master race it's trying to create, among other things, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome, as always, to one of our favorite guests. He is the great Gordon Chang, one of our duty experts on China, a man who has studied closely what the Chinese Communist Party is up to and helps the rest of us understand it brilliantly. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also a featured guest in numerous other outlets, including Fox News, and be sure to follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You've been writing a couple of things that I really wanted to make sure we covered with our audience because they're vitally important. One is a topic that we visit about with you and others a lot, but you wrote about it at the Gatestone Institute recently in a very powerful way, and that is you took on the Biden-Harris administration for basically saying it's okay to be underwriting the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it poses to us. Remind us what they're doing that is signaling that, and then let's talk about the implications of it.
6 days after President Biden took the oath of office, his Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control issued what's known as General License Number 1A. And what this did was it postponed for several months the application of part of President Trump's executive order 13959 of November 12th. In November, President Trump banned America's investment into China's military-linked companies. In other words, Trump said, we are no longer going to finance the Chinese military. Well, what Biden has done is tried to postpone and effectively postponed an important part of that executive order, which means that now Americans can continue to finance the machine that is building the weapons that are going to be used to kill Americans.
I consider this to be one of President Trump's most important executive orders, Gordon, and as I think you're probably aware, it was very difficult to get the Treasury Department under Steven Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary, to go along with it. In fact, that you mentioned that this is the Treasury Department's 1A order. Well, 1 was an order that was issued by the Mnuchin Department of the Treasury that essentially undermined the President Trump's executive order 13959. And this sounds like a lot of inside baseball, but it is simply noteworthy because whatever the president's view is of putting American investors' money into not just Chinese companies, not just companies that are subject to the diktat of the Chinese Communist Party to do what they tell them to do, but specifically the military-industrial complex of China, which is building weapons with which to kill Americans. The Treasury Department doesn't want to interfere with such investments. And so what we have now, apparently, though technically, I guess, as you say, it's under review, is that the president himself thinks this is okay, which harkens back to something he did back in May of 2013 with a memorandum of understanding. If you would, remind us about that, Gordon, and what it did to open up our capital markets to the Chinese Well, on preferential terms, no less.
Yeah, in 2013, we have our Public Accounting Oversight Board enter into a memorandum agreement with the counterpart in China, which essentially permitted Chinese companies to list on U.S. exchanges but not meet disclosure requirements in U.S. law. And it was, first of all, a bargain which favored the Chinese and didn't favor us at all. And then the Chinese, of course, proceeded to not honor its minimal obligations under that memorandum agreement. And as you point out, that's opened the floodgates to China to access American markets. There have been a number of frauds perpetrated by Chinese companies on American investors. And this goes to your broader point that Wall Street is very happy to have China list its companies here and for us to invest in China, regardless of the consequences. The idea that American companies, for instance, cannot do business with Chinese military-linked companies because of the Commerce Department's entity list, but we can go finance them, is just hideous. And we're not talking just about Wall Street professionals putting their money into these Chinese companies. We're talking perhaps 160 million Americans, because this is pension money. So a lot of Americans...
They're putting your money into it.
Our money into this without our knowledge, without our consent, and certainly against our interests.
And Gordon, one other piece of this that I'd like you just to comment on, there was much thrashing around in the Trump years of this effort to get some corrections to China's, economic warfare against us. And the president imposed tariffs and he put in train extensive negotiations with them, which ultimately... belched out this so-called phase one agreement. Not much came of that, Gordon, though, except the permission to Wall Street firms to have wholly owned subsidiaries in China to massively increase their involvement with the Chinese and underwriting the kinds of things that we've just been talking about. The military, yes, but the Belt and Road Initiative, the oppression of the Uyghurs and others in China, and building South China Sea islands, and on and on and on. Talk a little bit about that particular deal and what its net effect is as well.
Well, what we've been doing is shoveling trillions of dollars into China so that it can accomplish its ambitions. And those ambitions, of course, are to undermine not only the international system, but also the United States. We know that Chinese leader Xi Jinping has been dropping hints for more than a decade that China is the only legitimate state in the world. We've had Chinese officials recently talking about how the moon and Mars should be part of the People's Republic of China and how it should exclude others from going to those heavenly bodies. This is a danger not only to the world, to the whole concept of civilization, because as you point out, China's committing genocide and crimes against humanity. And in this context, we need to point out that we're a party to the Genocide Convention of 1948. China's committing genocide. We have an obligation to prevent and punish genocide. And that does not include sending trillions of dollars. Some people have estimated $3 trillion, as you pointed out, to finance these barbarous acts.
Amen. Gordon, let me turn to one other thing that you've written about recently at Gatestone Institute that is absolutely terrifying, I think, and it has to do with the sort of bioengineering of human beings. We're not entirely clear the full extent of this program, but talk about what the Chinese are doing, as you put it, to create a master race.
Yeah. Director of National Intelligence John Radcliffe, in a December 3 op-ed, talk about how China's conducting experiments leading to the creation of super soldiers. But we do know for sure that a researcher at the Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen, He Jianqoi, actually was the first person to use the CRISPR tool to edit human embryos to produce live births. What he did was he removed the CCR5 gene, and he said he did this to give the girls a immunity to HIV, but there are also strong suggestions he did this to enhance their intelligence. This is not the only experiment that Chinese researchers have conducted on human embryos, and so we've got to be really concerned that China is trying to create a new species of super enhanced Chinese, who will not only be the super soldiers that John Radcliffe talked about, but will possess capabilities that nobody else on the planet has. And this is ghastly. This research is, and experimentation is not permitted elsewhere. And we have a number of people, including Americans, going to China to conduct these experiments because it is permitted there. And so right now, this is one of the most dangerous trends in the world today.
It's almost impossible to get your head around this, Gordon. And there are, of course, profound ethical issues that cause us and others to recoil in horror, as you say, from this kind of behavior. And yet, this sort of transhuman agenda is clearly part and parcel of what the Chinese Communist Party is prepared to do, whether it's for military purposes or perhaps ultimately a more productive capacity from their, you know, people for commercial reasons. Who knows? But it is terrifying, really, when you think about what it could translate into. And I was particularly struck by something that you wrote about in your Gatestone piece, Gordon, in which you talked about not just trying to enhance human capabilities, but to try to give human attributes to chimpanzees or other animals. You commented, hadn't they seen the Planet of the Apes? And that's kind of where we seem to be headed with these guys. And it's just another example of what a mortal peril, really, the Chinese Communist Party represents. Oh.
Yes. Well, there's a researcher named Bing Su at the Kunming Institute of Zoology, which is state-run, and he's inserted the human MCPH1 gene, which develops the brain, into a monkey. And his new experiments are going to be inserting human genes to not only enhance intelligence or to create human intelligence, but also to give monkeys human language skills. And so essentially what we're having here is not only gene editing humans, we're now creating animals with extraordinary capabilities. And those are our experiments are in the mainstream of what China's been doing, because these are not the only ones that have been occurring. They've been mixing, for instance, pig and monkey DNA. The question is, what the hell is going on there? And so this is really dangerous, because they could destroy humanity with these types of experiments.
Indeed they can, and that may well be their intention, at least our part of it. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for today. Thank you so much for your time, as well as the great work you do, among other places, at the Gatestone Institute. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis about a new revolutionary no-go zone in Austin, Texas. What's up with that?
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He has had an extraordinary career of service to our country, in the uniform of the United States Army, in the ununiform, I guess one might say, of an undercover operative for the Central Intelligence Agency, as an assistant attorney general in the state of Washington, as a candidate for Congress from Maryland, and as an author, as well as an extremely prolific essayist. One of his works of nonfiction is Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency, and you can find his daily output, mostly daily, and certainly always impressive, at andmagazine.com. So let me ask you, Sam, about something you've just published in the past day or so, and that I find, well, kind of head-exploding. There is something called Orisha Land in a part of Texas that I'd never heard of before. Tell us about its provenance and its implications.
Right. So Orisha Land is the newest I guess, autonomous zone to appear inside the United States. But this is a long way from the CHAZ, if people remember the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle, which was a few blocks where the crazy people got together and declared they no longer belonged to the United States, and it existed for about 3 weeks before the Seattle PD was finally allowed to go in and clean it out. Originally, it was a much bigger construct. It has an 11-mile perimeter, a big chunk of what was, until it seceded, Austin, Texas. And it is a Marxist black republic, expressly so in its charter. It's formed by a group called 400 plus 1, which 400 is a reference to the 400 years that the group says black Africans were held in slavery, and the plus 1 is to signify that nothing has changed and they are effectively still held in slavery. So as of now, this zone, which again is an expressly Marxist territory, no longer belongs to Texas or the United States.
Well, that may be what they're declaring, but do they actually own this land? Do they actually have the agreement of all of the people who live within this 11-mile perimeter that they're now part of a seceded, separate black Marxist entity that no longer has any relationship to the state of Texas or the nation of the United States?
Well, of course, they have nobody's agreement. I mean, they have no agreement from any government entity. Texas certainly didn't agree to this. But, you know, they're not screwing around. They're completely serious. So they have a website for Original Land. They have a website for the group. By the way, if you're not black, if you're white and you want to help them, you can actually go on to another website they operate called the Allyship, where you can sign up to make monthly reparation payments to them. But they have a whole list of very specific revolutionary legal principles, what they call revolutionary law. It starts with the police are abolished. And then it moves on to there is no private property. To every Marxist principle you could think of, with the added twist that there's what's become the usual attack on the patriarchy and any traditional family structure and any traditional gender roles that seems to have now been adopted as standard by these Marxist groups in the country. And they then go on, directly to your point, to say that they understand that there will be resistance from the state, and they expressly intend to fight back. So, to my knowledge, that has not happened yet, but they are, they appear to know what they are about, and they also expressly indicate that, look, this is not the sum total of their ambitions. They're not here to just take a piece of Austin, Texas, and break it off. This is the beginning. There will be others, and the intention is to create what they call a pan-African homeland.
Which would be in other places not adjacent to this particular enclave, I take it.
That's the implication. The implication is that you're going to see these kinds of things starting to pop up all over the place. And, this is against the back. The ideology here, maybe the gender thing is new. Otherwise, the ideology here could have been lifted directly from the Black Panthers of, the 60s and the 70s. And, it is ideologically, there's a direct connection here is what I'm saying. So, there's an armed component here too. Now on their website and so forth, they're careful to dance around that. But this is occurring against the backdrop of a series of black revolutionary organizations that have arisen in the United States over the last few years. Black Lives Matter, but other groups that literally have been marching in formation with every guy armed, like the folks that marched to Stone Mountain last year. It was like 1,000 guys with AR-15s marching through the streets, and they talking expressly about, well, we're here to, I mean, ultimately the point is to shoot people. So it's about as expressly revolutionary as you can get.
Yeah. Have you seen any response to this pronouncement by the authorities? I mean, they're within miles, I guess, of the state capital of Texas and the governor's office and so on. Is there any pushback from the authorities there, or for that matter, the federal authorities?
That does not appear to be any pushback from anybody. I mean, there's a park within this zone, which has been officially declared to be the capital of Orishaland, and tent encampments that have been set up and all sorts of physical manifestations of this, and nobody's doing anything to stop it, of course. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is busy fencing off the Capitol and convincing everybody that white supremacists are the number one danger to the Republic, so it would be very, very inconvenient for her, of course, to have to acknowledge that this kind of thing is happening.
So far, they have not fenced off this territory, as I understand it, but presumably that will be an ambition in due course if they're not resisted. Sam, thank you for bringing this to our attention. It is stunning, and I trust that you will be raising an alarm that will be responded to by those authorities at the local, federal level and state, of course. Let me ask you about one other thing before we let you go. You have written a piece at AND Magazine, and a new website has provided some more detail. The Accountability Initiative, I believe it's called, .org, has raised an alarm about Deb Haaland, a woman who is awaiting confirmation by the United States Senate. It looks as though she has the votes to get it, to become the next Secretary of the Interior. Two quick questions. One is, what do we know about Deb Haaland that should be disqualifying? And B, what would she be able to do as the Secretary of Interior that might be troubling given her associations?
Well, what we know is that Deb Haaland has been championed for Secretary of the Interior by the Communist Party of the United States, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is a Marxist entity, and it is, by the way, aligned with the Chinese Communist Party. We know that Haaland herself has appeared at, for instance, at events holding signs in favor of the Answer Coalition, which is a anti-U.S., anti-Israel coalition of communist and leftist groups, by the way, pro-North Korean, if that it's mind-boggling that any American is. Yeah, and you know, obviously she's Secretary of the Interior, which will give, if she's succeeds, she will be, or if she's confirmed, she will have incredible power over vast swaths of federal land and obviously all the resources associated with them. So the idea of having somebody who appears, I mean, with that support, you have to presume that she herself has these communist sympathies and leanings, and having somebody like this in charge of all of that ought to really disturb people.
And it's not just that she was promoted for this. She has long-standing ties to leaders of the Chinese Communist, the Communist Party of the United States, and presumably through them connections with others. Very worrying stuff indeed. I hope, Sam Faddis, that your warnings on both of these scores will be really heard and responded to, most especially and most immediately by members of the United States Senate. Thank you for your time today, Sam, for all the great work you do at andmagazine.com. Check it out, folks. Hope you join us again tomorrow, same time, same station, for more of Secure Freedom Radio. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.